what high value products can we really bring to market? So I'm not thinking about necessarily textiles, but I'm thinking about, can we get into the battery side of things, biomembranes and batteries? Can we get into bioplastics? Can we get into activated carbons? Those types of scenarios going forward that are much higher value. But now I'm not thinking about trying to get and capture all the bioplastic market or all the.
Hey guys, it's Mandy with Global Hemp Association. I wanted to say thank you so much for joining. I'm excited about the opportunity to build a relationship and connect this supply chain. I mean, after all, that's why we started the association. Our association was built on the foundation of connecting supply chain, building relationships, and helping you grow your business. Anyone from farmers, manufacturers, and distributors, people that are passionate about the supply chain, and those creating products selling into biofuels, plastics, textiles, construction, and building materials. Hello, everybody. As you join, please drop in and say hello. Let us know where you're coming from, any questions. We'd love to answer questions today. So I'm really excited about this, I guess, interview or discussion. I guess it's not even really so much of an interview as more a fireside chat. But I do want to point out, don't you like my Christmas tree, Tyler?
Very nice. Yeah, I unfortunately didn't decorate my office at the house, or my wife didn't decorate the office. So, I guess I'll have to.
Unintentionally. That's awesome. Well, this is my living room also, and so I don't really escape or go very far. I had to move my office from my bedroom because I found myself just working in my bedroom and living in my bedroom and not ever getting out. And so I had to come out. Anyways, I'm really excited to have you on today, Tyler. Would you mind giving everybody a real quick introduction about who you are working on and kind of where you came to get into this journey? Did I lose you? Are you there?
Yep. I'm still here, but you're frozen. But
are you still there? My internet.
Yes.
Just got. So it looks like my internet is being funny. Let me see. Can you hear me right now?
I can hear you, but you are frozen.
Okay. Well, I can hear you just fine. So go ahead.
All right. So. Thanks for the opportunity to be here this morning. And my name's Tyler Mark. I'm from the University of Kentucky. I'm an associate professor there, mostly in production economics. I've been working on the hemp space since about 2014. I got kind of interested in that. When I start to look back in my family farm history, hemp was one of those crops being grown. Since I'm originally from Kentucky, it kind of made sense to take an opportunity to spend some time in this crop and learn more about it, as well as an opportunity to re-engage with the stakeholders across the state and across the country in this space with a crop that has an opportunity to expand rapidly. And we saw some rapid expansion. We'll talk maybe more about that later in this and now kind of come back down to reality so we can talk about the economics of those scenarios. But it's been a real opportunity to get into a crop that you can kind of see come back into production and watch it take off. And not very many people get the opportunity to see a brand new crop come in during their career and kind of be on the forefront of what happens and maybe even potentially be a proponent or not a proponent, but a leader in that space to help drive that crop forward into the future in terms of profit potential. For producers. So it's kind of been kind of how I got there. Now I've got a lot of different projects working on the hemp space, everything from the production side all the way to the consumer side. So it's been fun. It's been a nice ride, and I'm looking forward to seeing what the next several years hold for this crop.
Okay, well, I'm excited because like you said earlier or before when we were talking, it's pretty easy to talk about the tangible things that we see, right? But mm-hmm. Where is that value and the opportunity? And so can you dive into a little bit about what drives your passion around this subject specifically, and what does it look like in this research? You've got your hands in, you know, hemp supply chain and the economic piece and different projects. So can you dive into some of that for us?
Sure. So I mean, I think what really drives my passion is the passion that people bring to the crop itself. I mean, it's yes, I am a researcher. I spend a lot of time in my office and a lot of time maybe as an introvert, but I'm really an extrovert in a lot of senses. So being able to get out, that's been one of the hard parts of the pandemic, is not being able to get out and attend some of these conferences, because I feed off a lot of the energy that happens at these conferences, as well as there are lots of little nuggets that kind of come about when I get a chance to listen to some of some different stakeholders across the country and can hone in on some research projects. But in terms of the economic landscape, you know, one of the big areas that we're really looking at, especially on the consumer side, is what are the different markets that are actually available for this crop? Specifically, one of those is really looking at the CBD or extraction market. That's a consumer survey right now that's been running since February of 2021. Mm-hmm. We've been doing that monthly. And one of the big findings that are coming back out of that one is that there, according to that survey, there are more people consuming hemp products and especially CBD than I really thought there were initially. So that's a good sign. And there seem to be a lot of people, the non-consumer group, really looking at the potential of consuming CBD in the coming months. So that's been a kind of a bright spot in that. Maybe a couple of the downsides are is the education component, really, and really people's understanding of what hemp really is. So if we put out a word, ask for what's the first word to come to mind, the first thing that pops in their mind is weed, marijuana, cannabis, which I think is problematic for market development in this space. When people don't really understand what hemp is and what the difference between hemp and marijuana is, yes, it is a 0.3% THC. And yes, that's probably an arbitrary number. And yes, it's got all these other connotations to it. But right now, that's the definition we're working with. And that's kind of where we got to be at. So I think there's a real potential issue there with, we don't really want hemp and marijuana to compete head on in a lot of spaces, because I don't think from a regulatory and tax framework, we want hemp to get into that space, because those are two very different markets, two very different profit or valuation, two very different profit potentials in those spaces. So I don't want to get those two bogged down and compete with one another. So that's one really interesting piece that we're kind of working on. We're also working on it from many of you probably go to the grocery store and you have like a grocery store card and you swipe it and they track what you buy and what you don't buy. So we actually have a lot of retail data at the grocery store level. Now, granted, that moves us probably out of some of the CBD market. Yes, there is CBD products and CBG products and all those extraction products in the supermarkets. But that really allows us to get a much better look at the grain side of the coin too. So we're doing a lot of these surveys to look at what consumers tell us they're purchasing and want to purchase. And now we're trying to back it up and say, are they actually purchasing it? And what are the demographics of the people purchasing it? So we've kind of got two sides of the coin there that we're looking at with.
What are you finding? Can you share a little bit about what you're finding on some of that?
Well, you know,
specifically curious about the grain research, right? Because there's, I see it as such a huge market, but there is very few hemp products on the market compared to.
You think that.
Okay.
However, when we start going and pulling like individual UPC codes, and looking at this across the spectrum, we're seeing, you know, almost 500 different unique individual UPC codes across the grocery stores. So, you know, now a lot of those may be the same company and various sizes of that product, but we are starting to see that grow. So what's been the cool part with that? And, you know, I can't really say a whole lot about it yet because we're still in the early stages of the grocery store piece with the grain. Hopefully in the next 3 months or so, we'll be able to say a whole lot more about this, because we've got a descriptive piece we're really trying to work on to get an idea of what this market really looks like. We did some early research on this back in 2016, but, you know, there've been a lot more products hit the market since 2016 in this space. But in that 2016 piece, what we found is, you know, it's really a lot of high income, high education, females that tend to purchase most, and an older age group that tend to purchase most of these products. And now keep in mind, most of that's grain. And that's a little convoluted too, because it's when you break it down at the grocery store level, it may fall into things like granola bars. Well, granola bars have an ingredient somewhere on them of hemp, but we don't know how much hemp is actually in that granola bar. So we're trying to work out some of that in this newer piece to this research. because what we need to be able to do is figure out, you know, how much is being consumed there. And then where I really come in is on the backside of that and say, we have this type of consumption. We expect these types of gains in that consumption. Well, how does that then relate back to the production side? And how many acres does that actually translate into in terms of value? So that's, you know, so I get to work both sides of the coin. So that's been a lot of fun. I wish I could tell you an exact number. I mean, you see a whole lot of estimates out there of dollar values. I struggle with some of those and understanding some of the algorithms and stuff that went into that. Now, granted, part of that is because that's behind paywalls and you know, I haven't dug into the explicit algorithms and seen all the gross detail, which a researcher tends to like to see. So it remains pretty much a big black box for me in trying to decipher out how they did that. But I think before too long, we'll be able to put some more, hang some more meat on that bone to have some more dollar amounts. And, you know, the nice part about this is it's all university research. So it's public access at that point in time.
Okay. See, and that's what's exciting is once we're able to publish it, once we're able to really start talking about it. And I bet you've seen a big shift from, or we will see a big shift from the 2016 data to now, not only with what products are on the market, but, you know, consumer awareness about what hemp really is and what value it has outside of just the marijuana or cannabis, you know, medical or recreational markets, I guess. Right.
Yeah. And you can kind of get a feel for that if you'll go to like Google Analytics and look at the number of times hemp has been typed in or been searched, you know, and you'll see that that's continuing on a pretty steep pace or has been. So,
yeah, very much so. Okay. So to the nitty gritty of some of the opportunities, right? What is some of the opportunity, the economic opportunity around hemp? Can you speak to some general points and some maybe?
Well, so I think maybe the best way to tackle this is maybe by market. So let's maybe start with the extraction market. And as I mentioned in that survey, it does seem like there are some non-consumers that are leaning towards consumption of these products. I think one of the big pieces on that, when you look at one of the issues with them not wanting to consume, has to do with safety and quality, right? So how do we, as an industry, figure out how to label this or put the right regulations in place? Now, FDA has to play a role in that probably to provide knowledge that to the consumer that these are safe products, that what's on the label is what's actually in them. And I think that's also one of the biggest threats to the industry too, is if something in that food safety side goes bad and we have a bad incident in that space. So it's both a real opportunity and a real threat right now, trying to look at that. On the grain side, it really comes down, I think, right now to how do we market this as a superfood, and how do we get the cost of it down low enough to where it really competes with some of the other superfoods that are out there? You know, I mean, if you look at the FSA statistics or the Farm Service Agency statistics and some of our work, there's very, very few acres of grain production actually taking place. Well, if there's very few acres and you got a whole lot of supply or a whole lot of demand, then that price goes way up and it puts it out of a lot of reach for a lot of people. But one of the big opportunities there with that is, well, opportunities and bottlenecks right now has to do with, well, you can squeeze the grain and you can turn it into protein, and then you got the oils and everything else, but that seed cake is a problem, right? Because we don't have a big enough market sometimes to get rid of all that. The feed market would be a nice additive to that, or a place, another avenue for revenue for those producers or processors. But it just hasn't materialized yet. As we know, that still has to go again through FDA to get through the feed side of the coin. So that'll be interesting. But we also have another project that we just began October. That is a large USDA Sustainable Ag Systems grant led out of Central State University. And we're looking at aquaculture and what happens. Can we take the hemp grain, process it, and run it through the aquaculture systems, specifically trout in this case, And does that elevate the omega-3s in that trout product, as well as replace some of the other products, the other feed products that they're using? And we, you know, this is one thing that, that I've kind of learned through this process is, you know, I knew the aquaculture industry was large, but I guess I didn't really know how large it was. So the ultimate goal of this project, though, is it has all the FDA rules and regs in it in terms of getting this as a feed ingredient. And the ultimate goal is at the end of this project to be able to submit this as a feed ingredient for the aquaculture space. So we've got some great partners on this project on the grain side. So I'm really looking forward to where that's going to go. And I think that really opens up an interesting market that many people don't think about.
What kind of things are studied in those projects? You know, what are some different things you're looking at specifically in that?
Great question. So there are a couple different components. So first off is the nutrition aspect side. The actual leader of this grant is a nutritionist by training. So she's looking at the human nutrition component. Then we've got a whole nother group of hard scientists that are looking at the production systems and the feed ingredients going in and how those feed ingredients and the types of residues that they leave in that product or leave in the trout as it goes out of the tank. So does it matter how big that fish grows to? Does it accumulate in there? Cannabinoids? Is there certain cannabinoids that are residuals in that? If there are, then that becomes problematic, right? That's what FDA is, I think, really, really worried about is cannabinoids transferring through the system. Now, we can say that we have grain and it has no cannabinoids. Well, yes and no, right? Because you're still going to have some cannabinoids on the seed coat, you know, when we squeeze those. So you're still going to have some small amount, but does it really matter? Can we pick that up through the system? Then on the economic side, which I'm kind of leading that team, we've got one group that is kind of going in the direction of looking at consumer side of this coin. And are consumers interested or willing to purchase aquaculture products fed hemp? Does that matter? Do they care? What's the price point that we might be able to be at with those products? Then we've got another environmental piece, economic environmental piece that we're
Are you looking at the consumer's interest in a healthier fish? Compared to necessarily like, I don't care if it's fed, you know, hemp or cannabis or any other feed, as long as the fish is healthy. Right. And
correct.
I'm curious. Okay.
So yeah, that'll be another, I guess, branch you could say within the economic consumer side is, you know, how interested are consumers in a healthier product that comes out of that? We'll probably look at some labeling issues on that as well. Then we've got an environmental econ piece looking at if we shift to growing more grain, hemp grain specifically, what happens to some of our watersheds? You know, does it impact nitrogen and phosphorus runoff as to potentially less use of those commercial fertilizers? You know, what types of changes happen there? So that's an interesting piece. I'm not directly involved with that one as much, but the one that I am really directly involved in and looking at is on the production side in terms of how does this impact a fish or aquaculture producer's budget and bottom line, right? Because that's really where the rubber meets the road, right? Yes. Is if we can't improve their bottom line, then why would they consider feeding this type of product? But there's also a piece of that too that says how many acres and how low of a price do we need to get down to for the aquaculture processors to actually make a profit too, right? So there's this unique balance that comes in there. And we're also looking at life cycle analysis within this space as well. So if we move to a grain, more grain being produced and that taking the place of some of our traditional crops on a farm, what happens to that life cycle analysis? So what happens to those greenhouse gas emissions? Is hemp really more efficient in the production, or does it lower greenhouse gas emissions than other crops? So now we've got a lot of moving pieces in that project. It's a 5-year, $10 million project. So, you know, we got a lot of moving pieces there. And then I guess on the fiber side, Fiber is probably the last one that spent a whole lot of time thinking about. Are you back yet? Barely. So on the fiber side, we have a lot of infrastructure that's really got to get put back in place or put in place to get that going.
I hear you.
You know, when we look at this, there are very few decorticators across the country to do this if we're going to go that route. Had a very interesting conversation within this last week about, you know, is there a way we can get around the decorticator and change this up in terms to meet different standards for fibers? Because the decorticating process is a pretty expensive process and in the supply chain. So can we get around that and find different avenues? But I think in the fiber side, the really interesting pieces to me are have to do with what's going on in, what high value products can we really bring to market? So I'm not thinking about necessarily textiles, but I'm thinking about, can we get into the battery side of things, biomembranes and batteries? Can we get into bioplastics? Can we get into, activated carbons, those types of scenarios, going forward that are much higher value. But now I'm not thinking about trying to get and capture all the bioplastic market or all these different markets. It doesn't have to be 100% capture on that, but I need to be able to capture one or two, some very small percentages of each of those markets, so we can build this. So let me try and maybe address while she's trying to get back in here. Some of the comments. Internationally seems to be more products. Yeah, there is a lot more products in the international space. What we'll see actually in a lot of the retail data that we're looking at is we'll see a lot of companies that are international in nature and are shipping products in. So there's a number of like Manitoba Grain would be one that we would see in U.S. stores. So yeah, there are a lot of those. And it is a good thing from this standpoint right now is that Mandy, I'll let you get back in. Nope, still not there. All right, but let's continue on. At this point in time, yeah, there are a lot of processing bottlenecks in the U.S. and having international products fill that niche is nice. But at some point in time, we're going to have to figure out how we grow here and then we become an exporter of those products. One thing I would say on that side of the coin is thinking about the THC levels and what happens with those THC levels. So if we shift those up to 1%, we may have some trading partners that have basically 0% THC that could be turned off by that. So there's a problem there. So it's just, there's a balancing act when we start to think about the international markets. I do have a student right now looking at a lot of the international markets and a lot of the regulatory frameworks that are out there. So hopefully we're going to be able to provide more on that in the coming months as well. In terms of global food safety standards, that's really not my area of expertise. I know that there are a number of people talking about that. There are a number of people talking about potential regulations and standards, some of the ISOs or something in that space that could be possible that people are thinking about. So more to come on that. Chris, it's an interesting point, and that's one of the hurdles when we start talking about the regulatory frameworks. And you talk about that second decimal point, it may or may not make a difference. And I think that's really state dependent, right? Because these are still a lot of state and test dependent that can change those. So it may be the case that when the test was taken in the state of Kentucky, when that product was deemed acceptable under our rules and regs, then it was processed, and now it's shipped over a state line, and they test it there. There can be differences, and so now it's not legal there. So there are still a lot of interstate pieces that have not gotten worked out yet. And is there a particular test used for products and materials in regards to noting the THC grade? In terms of grade, I'm not sure about the THC grade, but I would say the THC level. Yes, there are a specific set of standards. And if you look at AMS's hemp website, you can find what those standards are for the testing procedures. Or if you look at the University of Kentucky, our regulatory testing lab there, you can actually find performance testing information on how various labs across the country have done in that performance testing. Now, you won't be able to identify the exact lab, but what you can do is look at labs across the country and how they've done that. You can see their tests, what type of tests they implemented, and what their THC ratios came back looking like. So that's an interesting piece to look at. What do numbers look like for next season? Cost of inputs have gone up. So yes, cost of inputs, Drew, have gone up quite significantly. And when I start to look at the 2022 budgets, I'm really having a hard time penciling out a profit in many of these crops, especially on the, I'm talking specifically for hemp. It's definitely going to be problematic in probably the extraction side of the coin, especially since we're starting to, since prices are still way down. I think we're still working through the glut of material still left from 1920 and now 21. Although 2021 acreage was down pretty significantly, I think you would see a state like Colorado who had like 10,000 registered acres and maybe only harvested 4,000 or 5,000. Kentucky, we're down around that 2,000, 1,200 acre mark in terms of harvested. So hopefully throughout 2021 and 2022, we will have worked through almost all that material so we can start to think about acres maybe ticking back up on the extraction side in 2023. In terms of grain and fiber, I think you're going to start to see those numbers grow slightly, not significantly, but they're going to grow in pockets, right? They're going to grow around where the processors for those crops are currently at. So I think it's going to be a struggle to grow acres where they don't have access to that processing right now for those two, because transportation costs are going to eat them up in terms of trying to move that material around. I'm not super optimistic, but what I will say is that I think it's nice that the hemp industry now is having a chance to reset and now maybe grow at a more sustainable pace, maybe than what it was in the 2019-2020 timeframe.
Well, hi. I'm so sorry about my internet going down, and I'm glad that you didn't get disrupted and kicked off this time. So, poor Tyler, every time we're together, my internet, I either hang up on him or this happens. But so I'm so sorry. And thank you very much for carrying on. I appreciate it. I saw Mike or Milan has a comment here. Food safety, GMP, ISO types of approaches for extraction will be needed. I'm an ISO auditor and have been involved in the GMP. Unfortunately, it's a risk management.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely a space that I think is going to be needed. It's not a space that I deal in or have dealt in yet. However, I've become kind of a jack of all trades economist in this space. So that may be next on the forefront to think about.
That's great. Can you talk to me a little bit about what feasibility studies include?
What feasibility studies include? Well, I guess a couple things I would think about is really how do you put together a business plan and what all you would need for that. Terms of a feasibility study. So what does the market look like? What is the profit potential? I'm probably also thinking about, this is maybe a little deeper than what a lot of people want to think about, but if I'm putting together a feasibility study, I also want some sort of net present value or return on investment type analysis done. So what does it look like over the next 20 years? And what are those assumptions made to do that? So you also need kind of a business plan, would be probably, you know, the first piece into that. I will say I don't do a lot of feasibility studies just because that's not where I work at. But there are a lot of really good resources out there. So, I mean, if you were to be like in the state of Kentucky, there's a,
there's a lot of conversation about them in the industry right now, right? There's a lot of discussion about them. And so, and I know a lot of it is about what is that economic, you know, sustainability for their community or their state or product.
Yeah. So a couple of things that we are working on that would help and would play into some of those would be, we are working on an economic impact study. It's not directly a feasibility study, but it's a, it pulls a lot of together, a lot of pieces for that. And it's basically an economic multiplier type piece. There was one put out, I think, by one of the hemp groups not too long ago. I think Jeff Whalen and his group put that out not too long ago. I will say, though, you know, just from, this is me as an economist, this is not all economists, struggle with how some of those are put together. And they tend to be very, it's unknown what some of the linkages are in that. So one thing that we are trying to do to really open that up and show what's going on in that is we're building an open source model that people can then take and modify for their own community, their own situation. Now, I will say we are building that for Kentucky, Colorado, and Vermont. So it's three different markets across the country, but kind of specific as well for those. So people will be able to take those. We've got the cultivation piece. So everything to the farm gate is kind of done in that. Now we're moving on up to the processing side. I will say on the processing side, the hard part is what does that final output look like, you know, in the grain fiber extraction space? Mm-hmm. Because I really want this model built for what's coming in 5 or 10 years, not what's here today, because this market changes so fast. So we've been working with a lot of stakeholders on that and trying to get a feel for what those products are in the end. But yeah, that's a huge question out there is what impact is this going to have on my community? I think what a lot of people fail to do is they tend to take a very simple approach, like a payback. You know, how long is it going to take me to pay back my investment? Well, that doesn't get at it. From a research side, I really want to see a much longer time horizon, a 10 to 20 year time horizon for that processing facility or that feasibility study of bringing in somebody. And I really want to see what their assumptions are made on many of this, because on a lot of these products, especially the revenue side, right? Because, you know, I think there was somebody in here, yeah, asking about data on forecasting with processing, you know, and all the revenue numbers or all the pricing side is behind paywalls, right? So that's not like NAS, mm-hmm. or National Agricultural Statistics Service, and we don't have free public access to that. And I think one thing that I would say is when you go out there, and if you're going to go out there and find that pricing information, you're going to pay for it, make sure you understand the assumptions of how that data is collected, because they will change those numbers and it will change your model in the end. So, I mean, when I start comparing different pricing services, and I'm not going to get into what I like, what I don't like, but, you know, there are differences depending upon which category you're looking at, and are they significant differences? In some cases they are, in some cases they aren't.
Well, and I think that this is something that comes up a lot, you know, as we've started to see a lot of farm trials and seed trials and research done on what seeds grow where, and considering, you know, when they were, there's so many variables, different people are performing research, and that's something that came up quite a bit. Can you speak to, you know, LCAs, you know, the conversation about LCAs come up all the time also. Can you talk a little bit more about your project around your life cycle analysis?
Well, you know, that we're still, I guess, probably 3 years off from when that's going to take place. So we're still putting a lot of the pieces together. And a lot of that data actually comes out of the first 2 years of that grant on cost to build that stuff. You know, the big question for me on the LCA side is how far do we go? I mean, is this cradle to grave, or is this a specific piece within that industry? So is it only a snippet of that? Because when we talk about going from cradle to grave, we're talking about mining the ore and mining the fuel or the oil to create diesel and to create metal for the tractor, and then we got to have the tractor components in there. So, I mean, it gets really, really deep. You know, and then how far, what products are we looking at in the end? So we're still trying to set some of those boundaries in that space.
We've had some good discussions about this. You know, when we talk about that cradle to grave and the circular economy and going all the way back, and mm-hmm. you know, the cost of those to be done for a product like a cell phone is astronomical because there's so many parts compared to some of these others that may be vertically integrated, and that may change your, you know, how you're processing and how in depth those are, I would assume.
Correct. So, I mean, yeah, it's a pretty costly adventure to get an LCA done for this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Drew has a great question. Are you aware of any grants that are available for hemp variety trial research?
Well, I guess my big question to you, Drew, is are you partnering with a university or not? Because that really opens the door and doesn't open the door to certain grants. I mean, when you look at USDA and a lot of their grants, you know, a lot of that is probably going to be driven at a university and you having to partner with them to do specific trials. There are potentially out there some other smaller grants like SBIR, which is a small business innovation research grant or something like that. So there are those. There's the value added producer grant out of rural development. So there are opportunities to do it. But I mean, you got to get down on USDA's website and dig pretty deep there to find those. I don't know that you're going to find many foundations, which would be another avenue to get research done that are going to support much on the hemp side right now, maybe in time. But
what about entering it from an angle of sustainability or regenerative agriculture, or, you know, an additional rotation crop, you know, to study the effects on the rotation?
So, yeah. So, I mean, well, if you look at the $10 million grant I was just talking about, that's for the Sustainable Ag Systems Grant. The Oregon State University and Jeff Steiner, I think you talked to him about his project on the West Coast. So that's through the same group. We do have at the University of Kentucky some other USDA funding, and we're looking at that crop rotation component. It's in its second year, its first year of crop harvest. On that, I haven't seen the results out of that yet, but it's got multiple rotations that are in there to look at what happens to the rotation. It's got some soil quality pieces in that. It's being run by he's a microbiologist kind of running that. So he's putting a whole lot of effort into looking at the sustainability components of that rotation and what happens at the soil level. Yeah, I think sustainability is a huge piece to that, but I think we need to be able to make sure that we can prove out that hemp is more sustainable than other crops, right? That becomes the interesting piece to that. You talked about opportunities on the fiber side, which I think one of the most interesting opportunities on that is, can we sequester carbon? And then can we take that top portion of that material that's harvested that we're going to turn into, whether it be hempcrete, hemp lime, whatever terminology you're going to put that in. And then can we sink that into another 100-year carbon sink? And how do you get paid on both ends, right? So that's a really interesting piece to start to think about in terms of sustainability. But, I mean, I will say that a lot of this hemp right now, whether it's grain fiber or extraction flour material, it's being grown in a complete full-till situation, which is probably not where we want to be at long-term. But I think that's a function of the genetics that we have in place and then many of them not performing really well in a no-till situation.
So, and that's been interesting too, because so many farmers that we work with on the fiber and grain production or fiber production are using drill and regenerative agriculture practices. And so I think that there's definitely, and I'm not saying on big scale, right? But there is definitely a large group that it's almost like there's a divide or a split. And I'm curious now what the research looks like for best practices, especially on the carbon, you know, because carbon is such a conversation around the hemp production.
Yeah. So, I mean, no, I think you are starting to see more and more people. A lot of people are using the drills, but they're probably not in a no-till drill situation.
Gotcha.
Yeah. You know, they're moving towards that, but it's a little different animal and trying to get that crop out of the ground and competing. When I talk to the agronomist, it's, you know, they call it a wimpy crop out of the ground. You know, now once you get it out of the ground, sure, but no-till tends to be a bit of a problem right now. But those are some things we're looking at in a lot of these variety trials that we're a part of.
Milan says she agrees, basically.
Yep.
Here too, the farmers need to have a price for their hemp crop, exactly how to get paid on both ends. Now, I think that that's something we're figuring out, right?
Well, I mean, that's a chicken and egg question there, right? Because starting out, that processor is probably going to have to pay a much higher price to compete and buy acres away, which is going to limit their profitability for them to get paid and be profitable on that side. And there's just not enough volume out there right now to create, a futures market like we would have in all these other commodities. You know, all these other commodities, we have a futures market, which is our price discovery, right? That's just not accessible right now because there's not enough acres, not enough volume, not enough production taking place to develop those markets. Well, there was a company early on trying to do that.
We're in a major transition. And you're right. There are a lot of groups that are trying to collect the data. But, I mean, this shift from the cannabinoid market to fiber and grain market, and then now figuring out what genetics supply, what processor that fits what end product, right? Yep. And I think you know, even once we get the genetics figured out, now it's a matter of what processor processes their product the best. And you know, now I'm even hearing on the farm side, you know, farmers are scaling to the density based on their processor, right? And what their new product is. And so, yeah, if somebody's moving more for a textile product. Anyways, yes. Okay, so Christian has a really good question, kind of back to the CBD or cannabinoid market, but what unique elements concerning strategic online sale efforts for full spectrum CBD tinctures would you recommend? And are there any suggestions you might have for a small company offering a very solid product that would be producing incredible results in its customers?
Good questions.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it's loaded. That's for sure. So we are seeing that, a whole different project we're working on. We've been going back to farmers and asking what sales avenues have they been using? We've got one group of farmers that was up like 7 different sales avenues, but the average is around 3, right? And online sales makes up the biggest bulk of that. So, and also from some of the other consumer stuff we're seeing is that one thing that really makes a difference is word of mouth on that. So one, having the solid product that you talked about. Two, having a product that is labeled, tested, and you can provide proof that what's in the bottle is in the bottle, right? So you got to be able to back that up as something to think about. You may start to think about how you brand that or create some sort of brand or label for that. I think that's probably an industry-wide piece that probably needs to happen, but how do you get into and move towards that point? You can put out there, you can't put medical claims on it, but if you get reviews back that talk about those results, I can't give advice on that, but it seems like that would be another good avenue for that. So I don't know if I totally answered your question, Christian, and I kind of bounced around it a little bit, but hopefully, that's really where I'm seeing a lot of people make a lot of their money is on the online side. You know, and if I'm a producer, I'm thinking about how I retain that value all the way to the retail level. Those are the producers that I'm seeing for the most part that are still around the industry. They've had that whole chain, right? All the way from the production side, all the way through processing.
I have to give a shout out to Christian and his product. It really is a great product and a great team. And I think so much when we talk about the branding online, you know, when you said earlier, look up how many times CBD or hemp is searched online and it's just increasing, you know, astronomically. So as that increases, you know, you tend to get lost. And so figuring out what that niche is or what that demographic is and speaking to that demographic is so important on the marketing side, right?
Yeah. And I guess if I was going to say that, some other things, Christian, you might think about is that demographic question. I mean, targeting those high income, typically older generation is where we're seeing that right now. We've got another consumer survey that just launched that's a little different. Actually, it just launched yesterday. And I've seen some preliminary data on it, but I haven't had time to look at it. But, you know, well, we may have some more detail coming out on that pretty soon.
Awesome. How do we speak to, and I guess, how are you guys addressing the hemp-derived CBD as a drug? You know, understanding, especially on the cannabinoid market, that label.
It is. It's a fine line to walk there, right? Because, you know, the way Epidiolex came in is now considered a drug. So you do have to be careful on how you represent that and what you can actually say. So, you know, that's one thing that I often get a lot of people say is, well, hemp is legal. Well, in a part of it is, not all of it. So you really have to be careful with that. And I apologize if I got my language a little screwed up there, but, you know.
Well, and I'm curious, it's so tricky, right? And it's hard because we're talking about the cannabinoid market and you're doing research on the consumer's interest and purchase of those products. And so I am curious how this will evolve and what it looks like. And Cortland and I have had a lot of conversations about some different opportunities that may even be worth, I would be interested in even, you know, discussing with you potentially. But yeah, it's definitely, and especially as you see these cannabinoid or new businesses coming into the industry, understanding that CBD on the label is hemp-derived CBD can be hemp-derived.
Right. So, I mean, and I really think that I kind of stated earlier that the only way that industry really takes off is once FDA makes its ruling, final ruling as to what it is. Then we'll know what is allowed. You know, it's even been a hassle to some degree of getting human trials in place too, right? Because technically CBD is a drug. So now when you start to think about those funding agencies that are going to fund the human trials, well, now you're in that
pharmaceutical.
Well, you're in the pharmaceutical space. You have to work with a pharmaceutical company to do that. Specifically one pharmaceutical company. And that can be difficult to get them to
do anything that's not inside their umbrella, right?
Right. I mean, they to some degree have a monopoly, right? So why would I open up to competition in some spaces? Now that may not always be true, but it's really difficult, you know, to get funding from like the National Institute of Health to get to do research. Now you got to do that research with a drug that's still considered a Schedule I drug. And you got to work with that pharmaceutical company. So, I mean, I know a lot of our pharmacy and medical professionals have had a really hard time with how do you really get these human trials in place, given some of the roadblocks that are there.
Right. Right. Well, and then what burden, I guess my next question is on the economic side, what effect does this have and this lack of education on the separation between the cannabinoid market and the industrial applications? How does that affect the growth of the fiber industry, for example, or the carbon markets or so forth? You know,
well, I think it has probably a really negative effect on that, because there's people don't understand the difference between hemp and marijuana. And if they don't understand that difference and they lean towards the marijuana, they're calling it marijuana, then they're probably not even in that consumer group that's going to consider it. So now you've taken a portion of the population that was going to be was potentially a consumer, and now you've removed it.
Yeah, so, exactly. Cortland had just said on here, all consumer products hemp-derived CBD crossing state line is considered drugs as outlined by the recent warning letters by the FDA.
Yeah. So
I think that's something, you know, when we talk about branding and marketing and reaching our industry, is that piece specifically and understanding hemp-derived CBD compared to marijuana-derived CBD, you know, and what does that look like? You think that there's I guess this is something that I don't talk about as much because we're so focused on the fiber and grain side, but once a product is hot, say at 0.4%, it's now considered marijuana. Can CBD still be extracted and be a legal product then? Because it's marijuana extracted? No, well, is there a way to remediate that? But yeah, it's a gray, well, gray area.
So, I mean, that gets into a really interesting area, though, right? Because now with the 2018 Farm Bill, you have performance testing measures that are done by each state, right? Mm-hmm. Those performance testing measures may result in not every plot being tested, right?
Right.
So you could have that get through the system. And yes, you could have that case, very case happen, and it actually be processed as hemp and sold as hemp-derived CBD, not marijuana-derived CBD. So, yeah, I mean, you know, that was one of the most fascinating pieces from our 2020 paper that we put out. When we start talking about all the differences among the rules and regs from one state to the next and the competitive advantages it gave maybe one state over another. And, you know, that's still a piece of the regulation in 2018, the 2018 Farm Bill that came out in the final rules. So, and I mean, I understand why AMS did it. I do a lot of work directly with AMS and we've had great conversations about it and very deep conversations. You know,
okay.
That's just where they're at right now.
So if you are picking end markets and opportunities that maybe aren't being explored or discussed very often, maybe end products or verticals, you know, where would you say that we should be focusing or opportunity is opening up that maybe giving some attention? Like, I'm really interested in what's happening around the energy sector.
Well, I think there are some opportunities around the energy sector. However, remember, energy is a pretty low value product a lot of senses. So how is that industry going to buy acres away? Now, is it in the form of renewable jet fuel that may have a higher value? Maybe. But, you know, where in that energy industry you're going, because if you go part of that harkens me back to when we started thinking about switchgrass, miscanthus, and all those other crops. And, you know, you could make a whole lot of things out of them, but you could make money out of them.
Right.
So in the energy space. Then it gets back into energy portfolio mandates and stuff by state. And does an individual state have requirements to have renewable energy involved?
Tons of red tape, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's
a barrier to entry for sure.
Yeah. It is an interesting space as a byproduct. So are there byproducts out of one of these industries? Then that creates another line of revenue. So, I mean,
right, that's exactly what it is. Like on biochar, you know, the energy that's created from the gasification or what that biochar then goes into.
So sure, I mean, there's definitely options there to think about. Biochar as a soil amendment might be an interesting one piece too, right? Because now you've got natural gas prices are up significantly, which has made input prices, especially in the farm sector, jump drastically. So there could be some options there. You know, I would probably turn that question around and say, what is the industry seeing as those key verticals that they need the research side to be thinking about of how what impact that might have if things play out?
Okay, now we're talking.
I'm deep in the weeds in terms of the technical pieces, you know, for the modeling components, but I'm not always deep in the weeds of what's the next product that's going to come out that people think. You know, because I need to be able then at that point in time, when that product comes out, what's that pricing point that it's at and trace that back through the system. You know, and if I can trace that back through the system and that makes a profit at the farm level too, then we've got something that can go. But I keep hearing a lot of people, they throw out all these products, you know, and it's going to be the next best thing. Well, only if you can get the production to take place at the farm level. If you can't get the production to take place at the farm level, it's a great idea, but it's not going anywhere.
So I just want to recap and make sure I understand what you're saying. And what I'm seeing in the industry is we're seeing processors that are close to farm that are processing potentially a lower value product, but are profitable because of their location and probably their distribution, right? As we build a higher value product and production may need to be shipped, or product raw material may need to be shipped all the way across the country in order to be processed and then manufactured and distributed, that's where we really got to be careful about the value on that end product, so that then the cost to the farmer remains the same to cover the transportation.
Right. So, I mean, you know, this industry is going to develop in little niche places, right? I mean, what's going on in Montana is a direct function of a processor being there that has an ability to move that product. You know, those types of things are going to happen locally until you get that, all that infrastructure in place. So yeah.
Okay. So I have one more question, because this is something that I don't think the industry talks, or I don't hear us talking a lot, and it's a concern I'm seeing. And I don't know that I'm going to ask this correct. So good luck translating. Okay. As we see these processors come on board, right? And right now we have one big scale volume, you know, potentially here. As we see more of the big volume processors come on, and we, where is that tipping point when we're producing, say that their product is their waste material, or their byproduct feeds those lower quality product markets. But these processors, say, that are currently on board are feeding those markets as well. When does that lower tier of product become flooded? What do we need to watch for as the volume of processors come on?
That's a great question. And I don't know that I know exactly how to answer that, because, you know, I don't know that we've really seen, I mean, even if you go to Europe and in other countries that have a whole lot more experience in this,
I don't know if it's like we will, though.
Yeah, no, I think we will. I think it really comes down to when you start to think about hemp in relation to a lot of these other crops. So, you know, in terms of hemp fiber acres, you know, we may be at, 15 to 20,000 acres across the country. Well, cotton just in the state of Texas is 6 million, right? In that space, what type of processing capacity do we have to have in acres to generate that type of piece? So, you know, if you look at a sugarcane mill, you know, those mills are 10 to 15 tons an hour or something like that. So, I mean, they're astronomical in size. So, you know, it's really hard to get a gauge, I think, right now at this point in time, how big a processor needs to be to start feeding the secondary industries that come off that.
Okay. Well,
that's an interesting question to ponder about.
Yeah. And I don't think that we'll know it, right, for the next year or two, but, you know, as we really grow. But as we see big volume processors come in, and I see more and more people wanting to invest in small scale, you know, what is that economic benefit to both, and where do those cross, and then we become flooded? And yeah. So that's the crime.
Well, and that, you know, it depends upon how big of a niche market those other little pieces are too. I mean, if it's going into a specific type of textile for a very small industry, yeah, it's going to get flooded pretty quickly. If it's going into cardboard, maybe not. Maybe you got quite a ways to go to think about getting into flooding that market, but it just depends upon where it's going. But that's a fascinating question to me.
I think those lower quality products, right? So like what lower quality is, I don't even think is defined yet, but I definitely think, you know, we're processing textiles and textile quality fiber, that what I would say is that higher value market, right? Where, and you know, earlier when you
I think that depends upon your processing technology, right?
Totally.
Because you could totally see where a high value textile you actually have to harvest that crop really kind of young.
Yeah.
And now you don't have the yield in it, but it creates a really high value textile. But maybe there's not enough biomass or anything else left at the end to justify doing that versus, you know, now you take it all the way out to harvest at a mature space and you put it in laminate flooring, then there's really nothing left. So it's, I think there's a whole, there's so many moving pieces in that. That's what I find kind of fascinating about this industry. And, you know, I really look for feedback from the industry to say, these are the next pieces that I think we need to look at.
Well, and I look at too, when the, even the term textiles is so broad. You know, if I'm talking like a high-end garment, silk garment, that's very different than a, you know, non-woven batting.
Correct.
And so those are very like, but still textiles. And so it's tricky, but I definitely think that, you know, the clothing market would be one worth researching because there was a lot of talk about wanting to enter that textile market and understanding where we compete against China and India and labor costs.
I can't say I know that there are multiple grants in submission to think about that.
Good. Excellent. Excellent. I love it. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Tyler. I'd love to have you back and I will get my internet fixed for you. I feel like I've dropped the ball on you both times. And so
okay.
I really, really appreciate the time today. How do people reach out to you or your team if they're looking to get involved or collaborate?
Sure. Feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn. Feel free to reach out to me. I'm at the University of Kentucky in the Department of Agriculture Economics. You can find my email there. You know, and I tend to try and get to as many conferences as possible. I'll probably try and make it to NOCO this year and a few others. So look forward to chatting with this group.
Okay, well, I'm really, really excited. We are sponsoring the awards banquet at the NOCO this year and really wanting to elevate the industrial attendance. And when I say industrial, this is negotiable, right? But the applications outside of only cannabinoids, I'm really excited to hear you joining. And I invite everybody else, use code GHA10 for a discount on tickets and booths and stuff like that. So shout out. I'm really excited to see you there.
I would say when I went to the Southern Hemp Expo, there were a lot of fiber processors and some other areas there. So
it's exciting. It's exciting to watch the shift and be a part of it. And thank you very, very much. Again, if you need anything, don't hesitate to holler. Everybody else, we have a carbon discussion at 1 o'clock Mountain Time. So in 2 hours. Where Dr. Mahdi is coming on to discuss carbon and soil and it really open up for discussion questions this time. So I encourage you guys to join. You can find the link on hemphallway.com or globalhempassociation.org. Anyways, Tyler, thank you very, very much. We'll see you next time.
All right. Thank you.
Have a good one.